Good evening, folks. Welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And given that we're now into a long weekend, the markets ended the week surprisingly active. Primarily, it's churn in Bitcoin, where the big argument seems to be, has the bubble popped yet and the panic begun or not? Given that there are futures contracts and similar derivatives being traded now in the crooked casinos, we may actually have to wait till next week to find out. Meanwhile, the term volatility was arguably an understatement on Friday morning. After trading not too long ago close to $20,000, Bitcoin has collapsed at least, $9,000 or so over the last few days. On Friday morning, it plummeted below $14,000, then rebounded, then crashed again to almost $10,000, then rebounded above $13,000. Headlines and continued updates from places like Zero Hedge said, first, Bitcoin plummets below $14,000. Peter Schiff, well-known Austrian economist, says, market to zero. They're going to go to zero or pretty close, he said, when the bubble pops. Right now, the only reason people are buying Bitcoin is because the price is going up. When it turns around, they'll sell it for the same reason. There's no value in Bitcoin, he said, because you can't use it as money. It's too slow, too expensive, and too vulnerable, and that does seem to be the real issue over the last few days, especially in places like South Korea, where there have been hacking reports, not necessarily in Bitcoin itself, but in the exchanges where people keep them. Literally just minutes later, headline said, crypto carnage. Bitcoin rebounds sharply after crashing to 10K. CME futures were halted limit down 20%. And again, over $9,000 now from its highs. And the carnage in the crypto space wasn't limited to just Bitcoin. Most of the names you may have heard of, and a lot of those you hadn't, were all down big time, except for one called Ripple. And who knows, maybe it was winos on Wall Street buying that one, thinking it was something different. Arguably, the real issue with Bitcoin and the continued manipulation of the paper gold and silver markets, although they rebounded quite a bit this week as well, has to do with all the ramifications of the deep state war. And that includes the economic aspects. The Austrians, and that would include your host, although I could say biblical economists too, because they pretty much boil down to something awfully similar, have contended for a long time that you can't print fiat money forever and ever without end, amen, without suffering the consequences. And we're getting awfully close, it seems, to that inevitable breaking point. There's been a lot of can-kicking going on for years, but your host has suggested, and many of you have heard me saying this for the entire Trump presidency period, that inevitably there will come a time when the blame shift occurs, and the manipulators in the Federal Reserve et al. Can drop the charade, pull the plug, and blame the new guy for what's been a fait accompli literally for years now. To no one's surprise, the FOMC raised rates last week. And if they continue to raise rates and stick a wooden fork in the economy, it won't be too long till we're talking about the inevitable in past tense. Meanwhile, though, there's a real battle on the other side of the economic collapse equation as well. After years of the socialist regime in Washington telling American businesses, especially manufacturers, you might as well just give it up, pack it up, and go elsewhere, because we're not going to allow you to make any money here. Maybe there's been a change. The Republican tax plan was passed and then signed into law by President Trump in the latter part of this week. The parts we've been told about, at least, do seem to be a real step back from the brink of socialism. The heart of the bill is cutting the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. Even the EU is squealing like stuck pigs, saying it's not fair for America to treat businesses so much better than they do. Why, that's unfair competition. And I wish I was kidding, folks. That really is the state of the socialist New World Order today. In any event, on the home front at least, there is some reason for economic optimism. But the bigger question remains, is it too little too late, the die already having been cast? Because after all, it's not like the biggest debt burden in human history isn't still hanging out there like a sword of Damocles. And I tend to think, yeah, the inevitable is still inevitable. What's interesting, though, on this long winter weekend are the battle lines themselves. Case in point, a new article by well-known conservative commentator and former presidential candidate himself, Patrick J. Buchanan, who said in an article entitled Republicans Bet the Farm that President Trump, every Republican senator, and even the GOP majority in Speaker Paul Ryan's house, for crying out loud, just put the future of their party on the line. Now, Trump has been touting the stock market bubble for quite a while, and that too was already fraught with danger. But back to Buchanan. By enacting the largest tax cut since the Reagan administration, the heart of which is cutting that corporate tax rate to 35% to 21%, Republicans have boldly bet the farm and rewritten America's tax code to reflect their belief that cutting taxes on the private sector will produce the prosperity they've promised. If it happens, they'll reap the rewards, he says, but otherwise, not so much. Meanwhile, the Democrats, the party of government, the progressive, socialist, communist, public-private partners, and the like, have come to see their role as redistributing wealth from those who have too much, which is everybody but them, to those who evidently have too little, but really aren't going to see much more anyway. And here your host has to point out that when it comes to the Keynesian money printing lie, Trump's economic appointments don't look any different than the bankster types of the last few criminal administrations. Which brings me to the bottom line, folks. Can the banksters still torpedo the economy now that finally they have somebody willing to step up and take the blame for a meltdown that was already long overdue anyway? I can't imagine there's too much doubt about it. And if polling data begins to indicate that Americans really have bought it and the blame has been shifted, what are they waiting for? We'll get around to the other aspects of the deep state war in just a minute. You know, the part that's centered in the Washington swamp. But there are other parts coming from New York City as well. I'm not just talking Wall Street and Madison Avenue. The UN was up to its socialist armpits in the war against America this week, too. And we'll do this one in reverse chronological order, primarily because the first one here not only hasn't played out yet, but it's probably just now getting going. On Thursday, though, the United Nations General Assembly, we want to be your big brother worldwide, has voted 128-9 to adopt a motion, get this, folks, rejecting the U.S. decision to put their own embassy where they wanted it and recognize Jerusalem, which just happens to be Israel's capital, as Israel's capital. Despite the U.S. president threatening to cut billions of dollars, says Now the End Begins Jeffrey Grider, in aid to countries that dared to defy him. Well, we shouldn't really have needed an excuse, but that one's good enough. U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley told the assembly the United States will remember this day. Basically, the only nations, say the articles, that ended up standing with the United States and Israel were Guatemala, Honduras, Togo, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, and the Marshall Islands. While former ally Great Britain actually opposed America and broke ranks with the president they don't seem to like anyway, evidently primarily because he's willing to call the Muslim invasion in America and in Great Britain what it is. Prime Minister May and Donald Trump did speak on the phone, says the story, about the Jerusalem issue on Wednesday after Britain opposed America in a similar vote. Downing Street acknowledged after the call that the leaders had taken, different positions. And that's a good thing, because Theresa May seems to have taken different positions from herself on so many things, including Brexit. The UN News in Progress has to do with the Blue Hat invasion of the United States, already in progress, but evidently about ready to accelerate. Over the weekend into Monday, we had this from the gun control and murder capital of the nation. No coincidence there, Chicago, where in spite of their success at turning that formerly attractive city into a literal war zone, what now passes for leadership on the obvious road to hell is clearly not finished yet. One of them, Cook County Commissioner Richard Boykin, went to, of all places, the United Nations in New York City last week to request that they, the Blue Hats, deploy foreign troops in Chicago to tackle what he called the city's quiet genocide. And I guess idiots like this ought to know they helped produce it. Boykin told Inc. concerning his act of intended treason. And if you doubt that, read what it says specifically in Article 3, Section 3 of a document that most of the Chicago leadership never bothered with anyway. In meeting with Oscar Fernandez Taranco of Argentina, UN Assistant Secretary General, that, quote, the UN has a track record of protecting minority populations. Well, and roasting a few, too, but maybe he doesn't care about that. There was tribal warfare, says this blankety-blank, between the Tutsis and the Hutus in Africa, and they deployed peacekeeping troops there to help save those populations and reduce the bloodshed, unquote. Here's the line from this historic ignoramus, or worse, folks. And yes, I'm being hard on the guy, but when you got people literally trying to destroy what's left of the nation and kill a whole lot more people by bringing in the very foreign troops that conspiracy theorists have said was their evil plan all along, in a city they've already made the poster boy for the success of their idiotic gun control movement, It's time for good people to either speak up or die. Anyway, he says, quote, "We can't wait until the mayor comes up with another 1,000 police to try to make the streets safer. Quite frankly, the people want to be safe right now in their homes and their neighborhoods, and we want to make sure that they're safe," unquote. And no, you don't, you bald-faced liar, because if you did, you'd let the thousands upon thousands of innocent people there defend themselves from the army of gangs and murdering thugs that you may darn sure could ply their evil trade without resistance in a city full of pre-disarmed victims. CBS Chicago went on to say that Cook County Commissioner Boykin claimed the city must, quote, "utilize every avenue," well, except for the obvious one that they're not about to allow the peons to have, and that's their God-given rights. "Chicago must utilize every avenue, except the one, available to protect its people from gun violence, possibly including UN so-called peacekeepers." So the city that gave birth to Al Capone wants to up the ante by bringing foreign troops onto U.S. streets. And don't forget, folks, they've been bringing MS-13 and ISIS in for years and dismantling and undermining Posse Comitatus because the founders didn't want any standing army on our soil. So, arguably, this has always been the next logical step. Oh, and that was followed up with this. Before the next couple of days were out, there were at least anecdotal reports of UN troops and or vehicles already on the streets of Chicago, and at least one major local AM/FM station, an Alex Jones affiliate, was temporarily taken off air when they tried to report on it. How's that for net neutrality? Well, in any case, folks, the UN gun confiscation and the Loretta Lynch mob Strong Octoon Cities Network, all evidently part of the same agenda, call it 21 or something updated, are also, obviously, still in progress and still playing out. Einstein had it right. For those of you who remember what he said about people who do the same stupid thing over and over again in spite of seeing how it doesn't work. Although when it comes to things like this, insanity may not be a strong enough word anymore. Sometimes, folks, when you start to try to connect the dots, given the level of skullduggery and scumbaggery, as I have increasingly liked to refer to it of late, what you end up with looks more like a Rorschach inkblot test than some kind of a picture. But I guess it still speaks volumes. And even though it's not obvious to most Americans that get their news from the fake news three-letter agencies associated with the Ministries of Truth, we've seen more and more evidence that the Uranium One scandal, so much of the Hitlery email scandal and subsequent cover-up, from bleach bidding and smashing hard drives to controlling high-level operatives, it would seem, within the FBI, and maybe even murdering a few that don't play along, all not only connects, but overlaps. And that seems to apply to the Bundy case as well. In case you missed it, the Bundy Ranch was a place where Dirty Harry Reid and the nepotism in that family seemed to be connected to all kinds of things, too. From deals with the Chinese to, yes, minerals like uranium that do seem to be located under the Nevada desert, the Bundy Ranch, and a whole bunch of other places that the ranchers no longer own. And for weeks there have been indications that perhaps pressure was being applied, because somebody knows what was going on, to the so-called judge in charge of the Bundy Railroad job, Gloria Navarro, who's not only an Obama appointee, but has her own connections to Dirty Harry and company. In a half-hour show, we really can't even go through the eyebrow-raising stuff she let the persecution, get away with here. But then a couple of weeks back, we saw the surprising move to allow a pretrial release for some of the defendants. Now, this week, in what's been called a shocking verdict, but really it's not a verdict, Judge Gloria Navarro dismissed the jurors on Wednesday, declaring a mistrial in the Bundy Ranch case, saying U.S. prosecutors willfully withheld critical and, quote, potentially exculpatory evidence from the defense. Well, you know what, folks? Used to be that was considered an abuse of process, and every, even crooked attorney, knew better. Looks like maybe these prosecutors learned more from the FBI than we've been told. A lot of that going around of late, isn't there? ArizonaCentral.com and others have reported that Navarro cited five key pieces of information that prosecutors did not disclose. Shame on you, folks, but hey, I guess since you're feds, you can get away with it. At least nobody got killed this time. But these included records about surveillance and snipers at the Bundy Ranch. Seems like the intent, at least, was there. Unredacted FBI logs about activity at the ranch in the days surrounding the standoff. Threat assessments about the Bundys dating to 2012. And various internal affairs reports about the BLM. Navarro methodically laid out her so-called reasoning for about an hour, says the coverage, citing legal standards. Whoa, somebody thinks those still apply? Well, sometimes. And case law before delivering her ruling, saying the evidence that had been withheld could have been favorable, gee, do you think, to the accused and could have affected the outcome of the case. Well, only if the jurors were paying attention. Navarro, however, listened to this, folks, and recognized the fix is still in, stopped short of dismissing the charges against the foreman and saying, hey, don't think for a minute that we can't come back and try to get you again. It's just that right now, the embarrassment here is sufficient for us to say, we better let this cool off for a while and then find ourselves another pool of ignorant people for the jury who don't know the kind of chicanery we've been getting away with. Navarro suspended the trial 2 weeks ago and warned about a potential mistrial then after prosecutors for the first time disclosed several documents that appeared to support, good grief, defense claims about the government's use of surveillance video and sniper teams during the standoff. Prosecutors have long maintained that the FBI wasn't involved, no, nothing to see here, move along, and that no video surveillance or sniper teams were used, at least none that we're ever going to tell you about, but have we ever heard anything like that before? They charge defendants with making false claims about snipers and videos to incite militia in the run-up to the standoff. And what can you say, folks, other than one more time they've been caught lying? One more time a judge, sick, has had to say, this is embarrassing, so we're going to pretend that we're going to do something about it. We're going to call this a mistrial. And no surprise here, she set another hearing for January and tentatively scheduled a new trial to begin on February 26. One way or the other, Achtung, we will get you, and don't think that a little bit of, criminal activity by the prosecution is going to slow us down that long. I'm kind of surprised they didn't let these folks out and then come up with an excuse to do what they intended to do all along. And let me say this, if you're not pretty cynical about the kind of stuff we're seeing here that's called justice, not pronounced properly, either you're not paying attention or you've been watching CNN and listening to NPR. Which brings me to the District of Criminals via David Stockman and his Contra Corner blog. Concerning the witch hunt, a headline says, Stockman names names in the deep state's, yes, you've heard this term, haven't you, insurance policy. I like the way he starts. There was a sinister plot to meddle in the 2016 election after all, but it was not orchestrated from the Kremlin. It was an entirely homegrown affair, after all, conducted from the inner sanctums, the White House, the DOJ, the Hoover Building, and Langley, all of them minions of the Imperial City. Likewise, the perpetrators didn't speak Russian or write in Cyrillic script. In fact, they were lifetime Beltway insiders occupying the highest positions of power in the U.S. government, or what now passes for it, a.k.a. the deep state. Here, he says, are the names and ranks of the principal conspirators. John Brennan, Director, CIA. Susan Rice, National Security Advisor. Samantha Power, U.N. Ambassador. James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence. And how's that for an oxymoron? James Comey, FBI Director. And, of course, Hohrmeister. Andrew McCabe, Deputy FBI Director. Sally Yates, Deputy Attorney General. Bruce Orr, Associate Deputy AG. Peter Strzok, Deputy Assistant Director of FBI Counterintelligence. Sick. Lisa Page, FBI lawyer, and countless other lesser and greater poobahs of Washington power, including, of course, President Obama, a.k.a. so many other things, himself. To a person, he says, and come to think of it, he did leave out Hitler either, did he? The participants in this illicit cabal shared their core trait, the one that made Obama such a blight on the nation's well-being. To wit, he never held an honest job outside the halls of government in his entire adult life, and as a careerist agent of the almighty state and a practitioner of its purported good works, he exuded a sanctimonious disdain for the peons, the everyday citizens, or as Hitler called them, the deplorables, who made their living along the capitalist highways and byways of America. The above cast of election meddlers, of course, comes from the same mold. If Wikipedia is roughly correct, Just these 10 named perpetrators have punched in about 300 years of postgraduate employment, and 260 of those years, or 87%, were directly on government payrolls or government contractor jobs. And as to whether they share Obama's political class arrogance, look no further than Peter Strzok, who left nothing to the imagination in his now-celebrated text to his gal pal Lisa Page. Quote, and I've read this one, folks, but it bears repeating, just went to a Southern Virginia Walmart. I could smell the Trump support. I loathe Congress and F. Trump. Says Stockman, you don't need the all caps in here to get the gist. In other words, the anti-Trump cabal is comprised of creatures of the almighty state, and the now obvious effort to alter the outcome of the 2016 election, by hook or by crook, was nothing less than the imperial city's immune system attacking an alien threat, which embodied the very opposite trait. That is, the Donald never spent one moment on the state's payroll. He'd been elected to no government office and displayed a spirited contempt for the kind of groupthink and the verities of officialdom in the imperial city. But it's the vehemence and flagrant transparency of this conspiracy to prevent Trump's ascension to the Oval Office that reveals the profound threat to capitalism and everything else that was once called truth, justice, and the American way posed by the deep state domiciled in the imperial city. That is to say, Donald Trump was really no kind of anti-statist and only a skin-deep populist at best. Stockman believes even his anti-immigrant meme was apparently discovered only by accident in the early days of the campaign when he said something off the cuff and got an incredible rousing response from the GOP grassroots. Nevertheless, what sent the imperial city establishment, he says, into a fit of outright apoplexy were exactly two things that struck at the very core of its raison d'etre. First was Trump's stated intentions to seek rapprochement with Putin's Russia and his sensible embrace of a non-interventionist America First view of Washington's role in the world. And secondly, even more importantly, his very persona. In other words, he's not the suave, reliable maitre d' of the imperial city and the lead spokesperson for Washington's purported good works at home and worldwide. And for that role, instead we have the slovenly, and I'm quoting at this point, loudmouthed, narcissistic, bombastic, ill-informed, and crudely mannered Donald Trump. And yes, says Stockman, he was utterly unqualified. Stated differently, says David Stockman, welfare statism and warfare statism are the secular religion of the imperial city and its collaborators in the waste stream media, and the Oval Office is their bully pulpit, the place from where the catechisms, bromides, and self-justifications are propagandized to the unwashed masses in flyover country who bear their burdens. Needless to say, the never-Trumpers were eminently correct in their worry that Trump would sully, degrade, and weaken the imperial presidency. The fact that he's done so in spades with his endless tweet storms that consist mostly of petty score-settling, boasting, self-justification, and the like, just add insult to injury. And that's exactly what has the deep state and its media minions running scared. To wit, Trump's entire modus operandi, so far as they're concerned, is not really about governing or a serious policy agenda, and especially, notes Stockman, not to making America great again, at least when it comes to the economy. Because by appointing a passel of Keynesian monetary central planners to the Fed and launching an orgy of fiscal recklessness via his massive defense spending and tax-cutting initiatives, the Donald has, by now, more than sealed his own doom. There'll unavoidably, he notes, and he's not alone believing this, be a massive financial and economic crisis in the years just ahead, if not the months just ahead, and the rulers of the imperial city will most certainly be able to heap the blame on him with malice aforethought. Well, he goes into more on the Steele dossier and basically how it's, I got plenty of nothing. Why do they resort to this outlandish and even cartoonish disinformation campaign? Answer, it's all they had. Well, other than what they did to JFK, your host notes. Meanwhile, Trump is literally polarizing the country and using the bully pulpit for the exact opposite of what they recreated it into being. The bottom line again here is simple and obvious. There was a conspiracy to prevent Trump's election. It wasn't the Ruskies, and now it's morphed into an effort to get rid of him by any means necessary. And it's coming to a head. Either the deep state and its minions and the media and the rhinos will win and put Mike Pence into the Oval Office, or the imperial city is about ready to break out in vicious partisan warfare, and it'll probably spread like never before. Add in an economic collapse, suggests Stockman, and what he called selling the rip might be a great idea. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks, now to the second segment of tonight's show for the 23rd of December, 2017. I'm your host, Mark Call, and if there is a continuing theme, it's not only corruption, but it actually goes far deeper than that. Money, power, sex, we're used to all the usual reasons, and that's not a surprise at all. But what we're talking about here is treason. By definition, making war against the American people, and along with it, the form of government that they thought they had. We talked about several aspects of that in the first segment. Let's pick it up here with a couple of stories from the latter part of the week that just emphasize the point. More and more senators are calling for an investigation into something which almost everybody who hasn't been participating in the cover-up is saying, looks a lot worse than Watergate. Because it is. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky in a tweet was the latest one to acknowledge that obvious truth and call for a genuine investigation into high-ranking Obama government officials who might have colluded to prevent not only the election of Donald Trump, but to undermine the administration in spite of their efforts. Former federal judge Andrew P. Napolitano in his weekly column asks, can the FBI get away with what they've been doing, including absconding with Team Trump's emails, courtesy of the GSA. Others, when the story first came out, pointed out correctly and obviously that the whole concept of what went on here undermines the idea of a peaceful transition of power. Clearly, that was at least part of the intent, especially when you consider they don't want the transition of power to happen at all. Judge Napolitano's contribution was to give a nice summary of the details of how it's done. And then in conclusion notes that the practical effect of Mueller's acquisition of the transition emails could be devastating to White House staff who once worked for the presidential transition team. Many of them have been interviewed by the FBI, while no doubt still being ignorant of the fact that the FBI had already read their emails. Stated differently, says the judge, the FBI was in a position to lead Trump White House staff members into a lying trap, just as they did with retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, by asking them questions to which the FBI already had the answers. Lying traps, he says, are reprehensible, but they are still, and I prefer this term, legal, especially if we no longer understand what lawful really means anyway. And, continues Napolitano, they're not unique to Mueller's practices. It's just the way the feds work today. Can the FBI get away with getting the Trump team's emails? In a word, yes. This investigation, sick, is not going away soon. Unquote. On the other hand, folks, the Republic is arguably long gone, especially in the District of Criminals. And I can't think of too many honest people who would argue against that characterization nowadays. And to return briefly to the original point, it's not just about undermining any peaceful transition of power or preventing a new administration from undoing the wickedness they've been working so hard on. It's about making darn sure that the people who are in a position to do it know and understand why it is they'd better not even try in the future. And while we're at it, let's throw this little stinker in here, another sign of the times. Lawlessness abounds, is the way the Bible described it. Ray Gano is not alone in observing that Rosie O'Donnell seems to think she too, like Hitler, is above the law. Because on Tuesday of this week, December 19th, Rosie O'Donnell broke the law by offering in-your-face, undeniable, very public bribes to two senators, $4 million, quote, no sh**, $2 million cash each, unquote, to vote against the tax bill that passed the House. She posted this publicly on her Twitter page. He kindly provides the link to Rosie O is a... with a clever, tiny URL, Rosie O is a felon. And you know, it's what more and more people are pointing out today. Under 18 U.S.C. Section 201, offering great big bribes, like $4 million, to senators to influence a vote is punishable, at least for mere peons, with about $12 million in fines, which to some folks would be real money, and or imprisonment for up to 15 years. Rosie O'Donnell has an estimated worth, he notes, of $100 million, and thus has the means to do it. And it's probably past time that somebody opened an investigation into this scumbag, too. Better people, like General Flynn, are arguably facing prison for a lot less. Because after all, if she too, along with the Clintons, most of the Obama regime, and the high-ranking elites, or so they think of themselves, at the DOJ and FBI, can all get away with it, it leaves absolutely no room for argument whatsoever, or in the minds of the American people, that there really are two sets of laws. One for just us, and you know who they are, and hint, it's none of us, and something entirely different for what Hitler refers to as the deplorables. Ayn Rand, in case you've forgotten, wrote this in Atlas Shrugged a long time ago, noting that there's no way to rule honest men. What she said is you have to put so many laws in place and then selectively enforce them that you can make anybody a criminal that you want to, but of course only those you want to, when you want to, and the rest is just plain old totalitarianism. Here next, a very good and somewhat brief summary of the current battle lines when it comes to overturning the election. Along with it, of course, the rule of law. This comes from the curmudgeon via LouRockwell.com and begins with the claim that three major institutions, no, not just TLAs, but groups of them, have banded together to destroy the Trump presidency. These include the deep state, the permanent bureaucratic government in the District of Criminals, a.k.a. the swamp, and, of course, Congress, and the streets, which includes most of the media, acting as a propaganda department for all of these institutions. On Inauguration Day in 2017, says the author, the WAPO announced that the campaign to impeach Trump had just begun, and then did everything they could to support that campaign. Main actors since then have been Democrats, the Washington so-called intelligence bureaucracies, the media, and of course the RINOs, Republicans in name only. Wings of the same evil bird of prey, as your host likes to put it, all of whom colluded with one another to create the Russian collusion crisis. First, Obama's Department of Justice succeeded in obtaining a FISA warrant to surveil the Trump campaign after twice being denied by a FISA rubber stamp court. Then Susan Rice got Obama to lower the classification level of the information they were in the continuing process of obtaining so that it could be disseminated to all Washington intelligence agencies. You may recall that happened shortly into the new year after the election. Obama bureaucrats then leaked that information to the media, and it has since been the basis of the continuing hysteria we still see today based on the implication that any contact must be collusion, at least if it's done by bad guys that we never wanted in there anyway. Before the election, the infamous New York Times declared the leaked material showed there was no collusion, but then switched to claiming collusion after Trump won. The anti-Trump elites were certain that a new Ascendant America coalition of minority, millennial, and single women voters would bring them victory. That, of course, and a bunch of Diebold, etc. voting machines, and the usual suspects on that front. But when Trump won by appealing to mainly white working-class Americans, the movement to derail the presidency and overturn the election began. First, there were recounts in some Midwestern states, and then an appeal to electors, I'm sure you remember this, to abandon their sworn duty to vote for Trump. And when all of that didn't work, the Russian collusion story hit full stride, and it was open season against the president. And various socialist billionaires backed this campaign, including George Soros, the most evident. They were all for open borders and a globalist government based on things like environmental regulations and non-existent man-made global warming, and the need, of course, to control everything you did as a result. It was all basically wealthy white donors against working-class whites, says the curmudgeon. The movement called itself the Resistance and, of course, was allied with the Democrats and DNC. Much of the effort was based on that fake intelligence dossier, which the DNC, Hitlery, and, as it turns out, the FBI, helped to fund, and then the propaganda press willingly disseminated. But the main point is that the peaceful transfer of power, and this is key, your host suggests, the peaceful transfer of power that once characterized constitutional government, since the Union of States was actually a republic, has now essentially disappeared from America with a K. Even the last four presidents, deep state minions as they were, still faced what's been called a crisis of legitimacy. Some of them for very valid reasons, but at least it sets up what we're seeing now. Clinton, as you know, was impeached, although the later Senate trial was a complete joke. No, not over selling secrets to the Chinese or the myriad of reasons that he should have been, but instead, it was only about sex. And that, of course, was well before the Me Too hashtag, although arguably Clinton was the original Me Too rapist. Bush faced 8 years of claims from the, as it turns out, loyal opposition because he supposedly won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote. Hey, have we heard that since? Obama then faced questions about his birth, which the press, of course, dutifully deep-sixed and demonized as the usual conspiracy theory, even though the document the White House posted of his Hawaiian birth certificate turned out to be an easy-to-spot, and many did, forgery. But you're still a conspiracy theorist if you can spot that particular WAPO. Nevertheless, Trump has still faced the strongest challenge in what has now been called a nationwide orgy of rage and spite. The intensity, concludes the author here, is beginning to resemble the state of American politics before the Civil War. And that's a comparison your host has been making for quite some time. Anti-Trump forces want to create a country, and indeed it's probably already a done deal, where the majority of voters are dependent on the welfare state, and famously, as previous opponents of democracy for this very reason have pointed out, democracy is doomed when a majority electorate learns they can vote themselves the dole. In elections that others have since called advance auctions of stolen goods, the Trump forces, suggests the author, would like to return America to being more dependent on business, economic growth, and your host would say, at least hopefully, the rule of law. But all of that is why there is a battle now to overturn the results of the election. And the ultimate result, anyway, as just about everybody is willing to admit, is pretty tough to see at this point. Unless, of course, we're talking about the short-term goal, which is pretty clearly Civil War 2.0. We'll follow that up with a very much related piece on basically the same subject, corruption and the overthrow of the rule of law. This one comes from Daniel John Sobieski via The American Thinker, and it indicates that even if the American people aren't being told what's going on behind closed doors in Washington, and I'm not just talking about lies in high-ranking FBI offices, eventually we may figure it out, or who knows, it might even get reported. That is, if the rest of the witnesses don't get killed or silenced first. Because after all, we do keep on seeing what look like Arkansides still. Fox News has said that Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe was supposed to have testified this week after trying to get us all to believe that the first problem was due to a routine scheduling error. Yeah, are you buying that? More likely, suggests this author, and I can't help but concur, it's due to the need for everyone to get their story straight about the details of the fix that was already in for Hitlery. And while we didn't hear much about it, nor expect to, really, McCabe, of course, has many problems, and he's at the heart of the criminal conspiracy to protect Hitlery and unseat the duly elected President Donald Trump. The Orr problem relates to Bruce Orr and his wife, Nellie, and their connections to Fusion GPS, the firm paid indirectly by the Clinton campaign and the DNC, and stiffed by the FBI, it seems, to work with former British spy Christopher Steele, and of course the dreaded Russian sources that they use when it suits them and deny when it doesn't, to put together the fake dossier, likely used by the FBI to fraudulently obtain a FISA surveillance set of warrants on Team Trump. Another McCabe problem relates to lead FBI so-called investigator in the Clinton probe, cover-up, and subsequent deep-sixing of all kinds of information, Agent Peter Strzok, whose text messages to his FBI mistress, Lisa Page, lend both intent and motive to the continuing Clinton cover-up and animus toward President Trump. We've already talked about some of the letters from people in the House and Senate committees looking into this. One from Senator Rob Johnson of Wisconsin, Homeland Security Committee chairman, shows McCabe's role in altering and drafting of the James Comey memo, supposedly exonerating Hitlery. Quote, the letter reveals specific edits made by senior FBI agents when Deputy Director Andrew McCabe exchanged drafts of Comey's statement with senior FBI officials, including Peter Strzok, his direct supervisor, E.W. Bill Priestap, Jonathan Maffa, although Mafia may come closer to the real pronunciation, and an unnamed employee of the Office of the General Counsel. We talked about all of this last week. The key here is that if they had told the truth then, it would have resulted in then-candidate Hitlery, having to be indicted by the criminal FBI, because to use the words gross negligence is the statutory terminology for criminal felonies. McCabe was the ringleader of the damage control team, trying to fudge the evidence of Hitler's crimes and soften the tone of Comey's exoneration memo. We've talked about that here before. And had he any honor, says the American Thinker piece, he would have dismissed Strzok instantly and revealed his corruption to the world. But of course, we know the point was to hide all of the corruption and instead destroy the administration of the man whose election they intended to prevent by any means necessary. And now we know what that means. Now let's not forget, says the story here, the connectionist should have disqualified Andrew McCabe for conflicts of interest long before any of this became an issue. His wife received large sums of money from the DNC and Clinton political ally Terry McAuliffe. Says this story, after including a lot of detail that we've talked about here but don't have time for today in a half-hour show, Robert Mueller, like Andrew McCabe and the rest of the anti-Trump criminal co-conspirators, consider themselves above the law. A lot of that going around nowadays, isn't there? And on a divine mission, trouble is, not so divine, to unseat Trump. Mueller's conflict of interest, starting with his relationship with James Comey, are well documented, and his role, along with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, in covering up the FBI's early so-called investigation and Russia's nuclear bribery around Uranium 1 are also a matter now of public record. McCabe and Mr. Mueller are the leaders of the criminal conspiracy of the century, a silent coup against a sitting president that does indeed make Watergate look like a third-rate burglary. Tricky Dick Nixon, once he got caught, at least had enough remaining integrity to resign. These people, on the other hand, have already made it very clear they're playing for keeps. Next, we turn to a related story, another aspect of that war, and it includes on people's health. Alternative health care providers, though, don't always have to die to accomplish the deep state ends. If they're small fry, it's usually much easier just to drive them out of business. A piece from WorldNet Daily back on Monday made that point. The article's entitled, How the Feds Shut Down One Christian Healthcare Provider, The Mission of Nonprofit Daniel Chapter 1, that was the name of the organization, was simple. Using biblical principles, Jim and Patricia Fejo created a series of products enthusiastically endorsed by customers who claimed it soothed their ailments. But that was enough for the Food and Drug Administration, SIC, and, of course, the Internal Revenue Service to launch an aggressive raid, complete with screaming and, of course, drawn guns, because only they are allowed to do that, to shut down the ministry. On March the 31st of 2015, the U.S. government closed the 30-year ministry of Daniel Chapter 1, claiming it might violate a governmental order, and they didn't need any customer complaints or actual evidence of harm to do it. The consequences, though, notes WorldNet Daily, could be dire. As Jim Fejo has observed, the rationale behind the government's action could open practically every American to the charge of practicing medicine, at least for Big Brother's purposes, if they share or utilize folk remedies, with fines and punishment to follow. I mean, really, they can already force you to buy health care and insurance you don't want. Why not? Now, Patricia Fejo is sharing her story in a new book entitled Called to Stand from World Ahead Press. And, of course, at this point, the ante has been upped. She recently discussed her family's experiences and their implications for all Americans in a conversation with Rabbi Eric Walker on the show Revealing the Truth, where she outlined how the trouble and the business began. Husband Jim developed a computer program that assessed the needs of athletes for proteins, carbohydrates, and fat, and then removed the guesswork for determining an appropriate diet. And as a result, Fejo introduced a line of biomolecular nutritional products that were literally pre-digested via enzymes. The advance here is the delivery process, said Patricia, because the products allowed a body to use the energy from food immediately, rather than spending so much energy on digestion, which had a positive impact not just on athletes, but those who were ill. They went on to introduce a line of supplements, too, all of which were recognized by the government as safe, but nevertheless, they encountered opposition from the medical establishment, powers that be, that want to, quote, dictate to everyone what you can and cannot do, she said. Nevertheless, Daniel Chapter 1 was able to operate for decades without problems, helping satisfied customers, up until the point where Big Brother, evidently out of nowhere, stepped in to destroy them. Perhaps most telling, Some of the people who were helped by Daniel chapter 1 actually credit the products with assisting their recovery from cancer. Oops. That's one sure way to run afoul of Big Brother, it would seem. And how dare satisfied customers be allowed to endorse the products in their own words, even accompanied by a disclaimer? Yes, they were accused of the dreaded false and misleading advertising. I mean, it's not like they were selling aspartame or SSRIs now, was it? Und zat is verboten. When the FAO stood up to the FDA and the fake news press, Jim FAO was thrown into prison, too. Says the summary of the book here, America is no longer a free country. Gee, imagine that. This, they say, is the terrifying story of how a small Christian ministry that created effective medical treatments was shut down at gunpoint by Big Brother, the FedGov, and called to stand is certainly something that no one who understands Scripture or American history can afford to ignore. Now we turn to the other side of the same coin, the fetid, slimy underside, if you will. And I'll preface this one with a warning up front. This will be offensive, perhaps very offensive, to people who don't understand just how deep the corruption goes and what the root is. It was really offensive to me, and I know why, and I'll come right out and say it. If we've been lied to for 17 centuries or so about how the law has been done away with, then for crying out loud, if we don't believe God Almighty keeps His word, changes not, is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, why would we expect a Constitution and Bill of Rights written by mere men to fare any better? So buckle up, brace yourselves. Courtesy of Jeffrey Grider at Now the End Begins, a Roman Catholic priest in Milwaukee has come out, nothing too surprising there, as gay. But it's the rest that your host will admit really bugs me. Yeah, maybe Grider's right. It does suggest another sign that the times are not only nasty, but maybe reaching an end. Roman Catholic priest, the Reverend Gregory Greiton, disclosed his sexual orientation this past Sunday to the Catholic St. Bernadette Parish and was greeted with a standing ovation from the deceived parishioners, according to the local paper. He also wrote a column demonstrating some profound ignorance of Scripture, your host interjects here. It was published Monday in the National Catholic Reporter. Because he, or so he says, wants to be a role model for others and help break the silence of gay men and the clergy, too, so that he could reclaim his own voice. Listen to this, folks. Quote, "I will embrace the person that God created me to be," wrote Greiton, "in my priestly life and ministry. I too will help you, whether you're gay or straight, bisexual or transgendered, to be your authentic self. To be fully alive, living in your image and likeness of God," unquote. Especially, I guess, if you're an outright rebellion to His written word. And he seems to ignore the fact that mankind got kicked out of the garden. Yeah, he was created in the image of God, and then wouldn't listen to him! So yeah, folks, your host will take a deep breath, and I'll point out the real irony here. You can reread the story in Genesis 3 if you want to check me out on it. Mankind believed the big lie. Actually, two big lies. The first two, you can be like God, and you will not die. And here we've got a guy, basically, pushing the same satanic duo. Thieves were created in the image of God, too. Can they embrace who they are and the person God created them to be? At least without turning away from thievery or other things that, come to think of it, actually don't carry near as severe a penalty in Scripture as what this unfaithful witness is pushing. And please, folks, don't just believe your host. For those of you who aren't Bible scholars, pick up a book, turn to Leviticus 18, and then look at verse 22, where you'll see the initial proscription, followed by Leviticus 20:13, where the punishment is outlined in no uncertain terms. And just in case there's any doubt, you can look at Romans 1, verses 25 through 30-some, for those that don't believe the Messiah didn't change it, just in case some liar's been trying to tell you that Paul did. And that's been a problem for the whore church, it would seem, for a long time. But I guess, in general, they're coming out of the closet and basically saying, hey, if we could lie to you and tell you for 17 centuries that the law is done away with, and your host has said for quite some time, hey, that explains what happened to the Constitution pretty clearly, doesn't it? Folks, as you might gather, this crap really does bother me, and I can't help but think, yeah, if you want to talk about signs of the times, no doubt, here's one. I guess if a so-called priest can stand up and say, I'm gay, and that's okay, and just who does the God that wrote the Bible think he is anyway to contradict me? I'm gay, and I'm going to be my authentic self. What's next? Why shouldn't we expect to have priests and other men who have gotten used to rewriting the Word of God standing up and saying, I'm a thief and proud of it, or I'm a rapist and proud of it, I'm a murderer and proud of it? As we've seen for centuries now, once men get in the habit of rewriting His Word, the sky's the limit, or maybe better put, hell on earth is the limit. Matter of fact, if they can break away from preaching lies long enough, they'll probably get recruited by the FBI to go join the swamp critters in Washington. And there's a problem, folks. If we don't understand there really is a real law and where it came from, then there really is no limit to the corruption or the deception.